a countercultural title that's been challenging both the status quo and received wisdom for more than a decade. The rise and rise of the Taiwanese print industry, and yet more major upheaval in the North American newspaper sector. We delve inside the print industry, good news and bad, ins and outs, reading the business truly cover to cover here on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Ahead in the programme, we take a look at Huck magazine's history with its editor-in-chief, Andrea Kurland. And we attend Taiwan's Golden Tripod Awards to celebrate the best of the country's publishing industry. But first in the show, we look at the newspaper sector in the United States. Front page are the travails of the LA Times, which announced this week its fifth publisher in just a decade. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Bloomberg Businessweek media writer Felix Gillette about what this means for the paper.
Well, every time they have a new publisher, I have a little bit of deja vu because they have done this a bunch of times recently. The newest management is now Ross Levinson was named the publisher and CEO this week, replacing Devon Maharaj, who was previously the publisher and the editor of the LA Times.
What can you tell us about Ross Levinson?
Ross Levinson is best known. He was as a digital media executive. He was the interim CEO of Yahoo for a while, and he first came to my attention when he was the head of Fox Interactive Digital, working for Rupert Murdoch's media empire. I think he most famously oversaw the acquisition of MySpace, which in retrospect did not go particularly well.
Felix, I have a question. I believe the LA Times had a few difficulties. Where does the paper sit on an American newsstand compared to its rivals?
Well, it still does a lot of great work, and they do have some very talented journalists. But at the same time, they've had so much management turmoil over the past decade that they've really started to fall behind their chief rivals, which I would say are the New York Times and the Washington Post. You know, there was a point at which I think the LA Times was really right up there in terms of the national newspaper brands and its importance to the American news-consuming public. And I would say in recent years, they've failed to keep pace with the Times and with the Post.
And it's funny because you would be certainly a strong voice from the West Coast in the U.S., which is very much anti-Trump, for example.
Yep. Yeah, it's the second largest city, L.A. It's very important, huge economy. You've got all of the film business there. You've got a lot of important politics. So it's an important city to cover. And, you know, the L.A. Times is capable of doing great work still. It's just a question of what their business model is. Do you have enough devoted readers who will pay for the product? And I think that's where, you know, they've really failed to keep pace is in terms of creating a digital model. What you've seen with the New York Times and the Washington Post is that they've been able to get people to pay for the product, to get digital subscribers, and that's really helped them sustain. Everyone in the newspaper business is facing huge ad declines, so it becomes that much more important to get subscribers to pay for the product, and the LA Times, under its current management, just hasn't been able to do that.
And staying in the newspaper industry, it's the end of an era in New York City, with the Village Voice ending its print edition after more than 60 years. The paper was founded back in 1955 by Dan Wolf, Ed Fancher, and Norman Mailer. Proper names, real legends in print. Another belongs to Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, who shares his take on the silencing of this most arresting print voice.
In its heyday in the 1970s, the Village Voice spoke for a community of people who were living in Manhattan. You have to remember, like, Soho, Tribeca, all of those neighborhoods, the West Side, the East Side, they were cheap places to live. There was artist studios, there was a radicalism in the city, there was a sense of a New York that was dysfunctional, there were crazy clubs, there was wild times, and there was very, very rich politics on the left. Now, much of that got crushed and pushed away. The city, its very fabric has changed. The kinds of people that live in New York has changed. But strangely, this comes at the very moment when a more radical voice is appearing in the US, especially as we see the post-Charlottesville, the attempts to stand up against Trump. So it's disappearing from the print version. We must repeat that it's staying as an online magazine. But yes, it represented a New York that slightly vanished.
When you look at this print publication, what it used to be like, what do you think the greatest qualities were?
That it did long-form investigative journalism from a left-wing perspective that you wouldn't find in the New York Post and its like. There was a world of glossy magazines that were covering uptown New York, but the downtown New York wasn't really seen on page like that. So his voice was radical. It was great at covering all sorts of things. But oddly, the classified ads were important as well, because if you moved to New York and you were looking for an apartment or you were looking for a job, you would often turn to the Village Voice and there you would find the listings you needed.
I think it's interesting that you draw a comparison to how the US seems to need an extreme voice still, seeing what's happening in Washington, in the White House, for example. Do you think there is need for this kind of a publication, maybe not where it used to be published, but elsewhere in the US?
Yeah, now, look, there are plenty of magazines who still sit to the left of center of politics, but this was a newspaper. This was coming out every week. This was essential. It was there to be bought. And when Time Out went to New York, it became a free sheet, so it was even possible to pick it up for nothing. Now, yeah, I think there is still a need for that voice. The reality is that much of what it was doing is taken up by online news. But still, even now in New York, there is a need for a radical voice.
And just finally, Andrew, when you think of all those readers of the Village Voice back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s,
don't
90s,
look at me.
What do you think they read nowadays?
Well, as I said, I think that what's interesting is that many of the people who are journalists around then actually got jobs on the New York Times and the Washington Post, and they got, you know, serious careers. And actually, today, if you pick up the Washington Post, you'll find also a strong voice of criticism, for example, against the Trump administration. So maybe many of its views were co-opted into other titles.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Huck is a bi-monthly magazine that's been around for 11 years. The title's closely associated with counterculture. Its editor-in-chief, Andrea Curland, joins me in the studio now to tell me, well, what's changed over more than a decade. And we are fortunate in that we have lots of nice editions of Huck, including the most recent one, spread before us, and a whole stack, appropriately, of other magazines, which we shall come to. But let me start a bit by asking, sort of bring us back up to speed in Huckland. Mm-hmm. What's your sort of one-liner when people say, oh, what's Huck exactly? What's the sort of easy, catchy, pithy one-liner?
It's something you have to have, isn't it, really? I guess we say Huck champions independent culture. That's the one-liner. And what we mean by that is we're inspired by people who are kind of going out there and making something happen for themselves. So personal stories of people who are challenging the status quo. And, you know, today I think the counterculture, or the idea of counterculture, is very different to what it once was. It used to be kind of like defined by this archetype of like the flower power hippie stereotype. But today you can kind of be making like a countercultural statement, like from all levels of society, all walks of life. You could be a teenager making music in your bedroom and putting that out on an indie imprint. Or you could be working in like an office environment, but shooting like beautiful photographs in your spare time and putting together a zine. All of those things are like transgressive acts. And we're interested in people who are doing that by themselves. We're interested also in like the creative potential of counterculture to forge communities. Because when you do that, when you make something, you tend to attract like-minded people and create a community around yourself. So Huck, in that sense, I guess, is an attitude more than a demographic.
That's
it's a broad,
nice. That's
broad
a nice,
scope
that's
of
a
people.
That's a nice kind of strap line there, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
But let me ask you, because we mentioned at the top of the show that it's, what, 11 years, I guess, now?
It's been going. Yeah.
So once something becomes a little bit part of the furniture, mm-hmm. Does that become easier because you're more sure of your ground? Or is it more tricky to continue to sort of push the boundaries and be challenging because the magazine itself becomes a bit of an institution and it becomes recognised?
Yeah.
Is that a balance that you continue to sort of strike editorially all the time?
I think it's quite hard to project how people see you. I think we're so focused on the day-to-day of like making this thing that we have loved for so many years that I actually don't pause enough to think about how other people see us. But what you can get stuck in is like the routine. Mm. You know, at the end of the day, it's work as well. So we have to like hit deadlines and make something. And it can be quite hard to like have that time to reflect. So you have to build that in. You have to say like, are we doing enough to push our own boundaries? And you know, you're naturally hitting a limit when you're kind of, you've done that thing once too many times and you want to try something new.
And that inspiration then to keep pushing the envelope, does that come, I mean, we'll reflect on this as we look through some of the magazines you've brought in, does it come from other magazines? Does it come from, you know, the old things, traveling around, meeting new people? Where does that sense of that reminder of the importance of renewal and a fresh challenge, where does that come from for you and your team?
Yeah, for everyone in the team, it comes from a different place. And I think that's the beauty of having a collaborative team who are all kind of engaged and excited about different things. For me, it was exciting coming on this show because I haven't actually gone out magazine shopping for a very long time. I think I don't necessarily see it as like a relaxing act anymore because...
Is it all work? I often ask editors that. Has some of the old mag-consuming joy gone a bit because you just see... competitors or, oh God, why didn't we do that? And this sort of thing.
I think I almost see it like a to-do list. Like if I walk into a magazine shop, it just reminds me that I've got a lot of work to do.
There's a giant wall covered in post-it notes.
Exactly. Like, wow, look at, you're very aware of how much work went into it. But for me, I'm looking at other forms of storytelling because I know you have a lot of people on the show who are like passionate about print, and I'm more interested in the power of storytelling outside of the pages of print and how it can kind of move and transgress from one to the other. So I listen to a lot of podcasts and I really love documentary film as well.
And on that point, I mean, again, I tend to ask editors and magazine people this question. We obviously talk about striking that balance between, you know, digital offering and print and how new media and, you know, social media is challenging the preconceived ideas and all this kind of thing. How does that work in your world? Are all of these offers part of that bigger picture you described at the beginning, or are the different media, are they sort of quite distinct? How does it sort of all fit together?
Yeah, I mean, on a logistical and physical level, we're a very small team. So we're a team of four editors, and that's the biggest we've ever been, you know, for very many years up until recently.
It's a compact team.
Nuclear family. And so we are two editors who are focusing more on print, two editors who are focusing more on digital, all four working collaboratively all the time, sharing freelance networks. So the whole thing is one micro being, what, you know, that kind of like has to all work together. And we're trying to think of ourselves as digital first because that's where we have to, you know, with our commercial head on, we have to grow our audience. But we want our stories to exist and be read everywhere, and we want them to be beautiful on the page, but we want them to be engaging in print. And social media is like its own massive behemoth within that you have to think about constantly. So just keeping the team collaborative and small is one way that we're trying to do that.
And I guess coming back to the ideas, so often editors say compelling stories, good storytellers, maybe it's not that complicated after all.
Exactly.
We'll reflect more on that. Let's talk a bit about your stack of magazines, because there's an interesting mix here. We've got some weeklies. I know you've raided your personal archive or the Huck archive, I'm not sure, we'll get into that. But we've got zines, we've got there's a magazine that California out of the West Coast US, which is really interesting from a sort of distribution model as well, which we'll talk about. Maybe let's start with the zine.
Yeah.
Tell me about this one.
So this is UMK, and I think that it stands for One of My Kind. I might have got that slightly wrong. And I was actually gifted this when I did a talk once by one of the three girls that makes this zine. And it's a zine that I don't want to put words in how they define it, but I would say that it's for and about creative women of colour and faith, or women who identify from slightly marginalised communities. And really, it's just, I love it because it picks up on that heritage of zine culture in a really thoughtful, beautiful way. And it's not slapped together like some zines are, which is their inherent beauty as well. And there's just so many beautiful counter-narratives within here that are kind of like challenging preconceptions about what you might think young women of colour are thinking and doing. And, you know, there's beautiful essays that are really written from the heart. And then there's like little vignettes of just introducing something interesting that they found on the internet, but putting it into print form. And I just think it's very bold. And I'm very, very impressed that these three young women went out and made it.
What's interesting about it from a design point of view, having my first browse, is it as you said, it clearly sort of pays homage to that zine culture in terms of the design, the layout, you know, the fonts and everything. But it's definitely not pastiche. It's beautifully designed and put together, which is no mean trick, is it?
No, exactly. And I think from what I understand, they're three young women from slightly different backgrounds and skill sets. So there's an illustrator, one of the girls is an Arabic teacher, and another one is an archivist. So just, I love this idea of like that intersectional blending of skill sets. I think it creates something really collaborative and beautiful.
Very nice. Mm. Good start. Where should we go next?
So I brought something really old from my personal archives, and this is easily my biggest and earliest inspiration, and it's the fader from 2007.
I love that. Can I just say, I love the idea that that's really old. That makes me feel super old. But anyway, it's ancient history.
But I kind of associate this with like sort of the beginning of my personal journey, I guess, when I was at that stage where you are just so excited by new things in print. And, you know, I do still get that, but this holds a special place for me because I think it blew my mind on a visual creative direction level. And I started becoming a little bit obsessed with the people who were making this. And the creative director, Phil Bicker, became a huge inspiration for me. And I kind of followed from afar what he was doing with his career. And he was just working with incredibly talented photographers who were coming at photography from disparate backgrounds. So he would pair a war photographer with a musician, and you would just get this incredible access and lens and authentic storytelling that you wouldn't get if you threw a music portrait photographer in with a subject that they already knew. Recently, in recent life, I've gotten to know him as a friend as well.
They say don't meet your heroes. Yeah. But you would, I guess, counsel that the opposite is true in this
definitely,
case.
Definitely,
so
definitely.
Nice. So, and just tell us, so this is number 47. We're going back to the summer of 2007,
yes,
a full 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Just describe the cover for us so we can take that sort of step back in time.
Yeah.
What are we looking at exactly?
So I actually haven't picked up the fader recently, but it was always known for its dual covers. So you would flip it over and there'd be two cover stars. And on this side, we've got this really cool Brazilian band. And on the other cover, we have Lil Wayne. But basically, the way that they approach either of their cover stars is with the same creative direction, just to pair them with incredible access, really good storytelling and good journalism, and a photographer who's probably spent about a week with them, I would say, or at least negotiated access on different levels. So all the way through, you kind of like just get this visual storytelling that you can engage with on one level. There's also a really beautiful story on MIA, which I know the photographer who shot it, and she's really, Liz Johnson, our tour, she's really entrenched in the music scene that MIA has come out of. And so you can just see that she's captured something that I think is quite unique. Their approach to fashion also blew my mind because it's basically documentary storytelling where you would get this tiny little fashion credit and you wouldn't even be able to see the fashion item. And I absolutely loved that because in our early days, we had those same commercial concerns where we had to please our partners with coverage, and fashion didn't necessarily fit within our mandate and ethos. So we dabbled with that for a few years, and I have to say that's completely inspired by the fader as well.
Well, it's nice to see that progression of ideas and something taking root over a decade or more and then manifesting itself in your own title. Does it sometimes frustrate you that, I said earlier, actually, there's no great secret to it. Do you find that it's frustrating when people say, print is so challenging, or it's very difficult and there's so many commercial considerations? Because there are certain truths if you stick to, by and large, spending money, investing in good journalism, you get a good outcome. It's not that complicated.
Definitely. And I mean, we launched just through that period, 2006 up to 2008, when everyone was saying print is dead. So I'm so far beyond even hearing that or recognizing it. We just don't even think about it anymore. We're lucky that we've survived, but I think we've survived just because we've kept going. We just know what we wanted to say and do, and we just kept doing it. In that sense, I think if you do stay committed to the kind of journalism that you want to put out and you believe in, then people will come to it. And we're seeing that more and more.
That kind of brings us full circle, in a sense. What's next for Huck? I've got the August-September issue, I suppose, in my hands here, issue 61. Liam looking moody, of course, on the cover. What else have we got to look forward to? Any highlights from this issue or things coming up? Can you whet the listeners' appetites a little?
Yeah, so since like early to 2015, we've been doing themed issues. And this is the first time that we've reverted to even having a cover star, a celebrity on the cover, but it's still a themed issue. So we'll be continuing with that template because it's really something that we're excited about curating. Every autumn or fall, we have our documentary photography special, which is what we're working on currently now. And for that, the theme will be rule breakers, so look out for that. We're also working on some hardcover publications, so books, and we're working on something that should be out next fall because the lead time is a lot further, and that's exploring activism more. So that's the two things that we're kind of like focused on at the moment. And concurrently, we are pushing our Huck Docs, which is our filmmaking strand as well, bringing to life some of these stories that we have access to and looking to do more of that.
Busy journalists.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we like to hear. Andrea, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Good luck with the No Regrets issue and on into the future. And come back and tell us about your future projects again soon, I hope.
Great. Thanks. Thank you for having me.
And now to Taipei, where Monocle's Kurt Lin attended the Golden Tripod Awards, which celebrates the best of Taiwan's print and publishing industries. At the awards, Kurt spoke with one of the winners this year, Eva Chen, on why she took a plunge into the industry, seemingly against all the odds. Also, the editor-in-chief of the big issue in Taiwan, Fiennes Lee, who's just launched a bi-weekly newspaper, The Affairs, to shed some light on the latest developments of the publishing industry in Taiwan.
Reporters Without Borders picked Taipei for its first Asian Bureau earlier this year, and one of the five Hong Kong booksellers adopted by China in 2015 plans to open a new bookshop in the capital of Taiwan. And publishing industry is thriving there. Many titles are rolling off the press from Taipei to Tainan, not to mention how the late Robert Wu, the founder of Elite, and his legacy of making the publishing and cultural industry a soft power of Taiwan. Today I'm talking to Eva Chen, the youngest Golden Tripod Award winner for the title of Best Editor-in-Chief at the age of 28, and the Best Lifestyle Magazine Award for the Chiu Dao Yu magazine, the bi-monthly print bringing fresh Japanese cultures and voice to Chinese readers. She founded about 4 years ago.
I'm very grateful for the acknowledgement. For such a young magazine like us to get this award means tremendous support from the publishing industry. And the meaning, it goes beyond the award itself, because it shows anyone who is willing to invest in print and journalism can yield results and progress. When we keep trying and trying new ways of telling stories and to run a magazine, this is a huge support of what we're doing.
It's a very difficult industry, and how do you get through all the odds and talk the plunge?
I think running a magazine is always difficult, but we started as a group of magazine lovers without thinking too much on business plan, but focus on content. And now we are facing another kind of challenge, especially when we're awarded. People are expecting us to do better and more. So in every stage, running a magazine is always difficult. I mean, given its challenges, the process from having an idea to the final product being in the hands of our readers so that they can understand what we've written, the whole process is fantastic.
Having gone through the first few tough years of business, do you have any secrets or tips for other budding entrepreneurs?
Key to success isn't how many magazines are in circulation or the advertising content, but how we find the best way to communicate with our readers. I think judges of the Golden Tripod Awards can see this persistence in us. Running a magazine is a continuous effort. Compared to a single book publication, magazine is more effective in advocating for a set of values in longer term. So the key for us is to stick to our voice and continue working towards our goals and editorial direction. Many magazines started around the same time as us, and they've since disappeared. The third issue is what I like to call the threshold, and then the next would be the 10th, because readers around then, they're tired of the same kind of content. That's why we have to find a new way to tell stories. This is the challenge for our editors, to keep thinking of new ways to get readers back into the bookstores to read through magazines, and not just for the beautifully designed front covers, but for the good content. So in our editorial meetings, we really focus on what makes readers read through the pages.
Okay, talking about starting a print business and new titles, we have to turn our attention to Fines Lee and his new project affairs. Lee started the Taiwanese Big Issue in 2010. It's been one of the most, if not the most, successful magazines in Taiwan, especially among the readership aged from 20 to 40. I went down to his office about a cafe he co-founded for his staff craving for caffeine to stay sharp at work and have a chat with him on his next moves while flipping through the latest second issue of the affairs.
我自己觉得以新世代的读者来看，他们还是
I feel like there's a prominent demand for media across generations. If you found your readers from their own perspectives, you can collect and curate content and use well thought out layout and design. Then you can reach a sizable market for an idea. I'm originally from a digital background, although I feel more in control when I'm doing print media. In the old days, when I was doing digital on the internet, everyone wanted to attract more commercial projects to sustain the business. The focus was heavy on click rate and views. Anyone with experience in running online media should know it's a very vague and difficult task. When you're not Google or Facebook, the click rate and views can never reach their thousands or even hundreds. Why would advertisers put ads on your website? By comparison, doing things on print is easier and more straightforward. I print a magazine at the price of $100 at a regular time frame, and the seller earns half of it, and we earn the other half, and I have to adjust the cost, the content and production within this half. Only then can I survive.
Why do you want to launch a newspaper right now?
The monthly big issue is very driven by highlighted issues each month. But I'd like to do some content closer to everyday life, in a new format, apart from magazine. Newspaper is a very key way of telling stories in print media. I personally love newspaper. I used to get all my information from them. And the attractiveness of newspaper nowadays is fading, I think. We take inspiration from the New York Times Weekend and Financial Times Weekend. The content is closer to New York Times, but the colour, of course, is more like the Financial Times. I think the layout of newspapers in the West is very neat and clear. Each section and font size are very formalised. And we work on that a lot too. Once we've sorted out the structure, we can go for more challenging and experimental content.
Why did you pick the salmon paint color for your papers?
Actually, the third issue is going to be white. I picked the salmon pink and white because I like to let Taiwanese readers experience something different from reading a normal newspaper. They don't have to be in boring colors. The front doesn't have to be with photography. It can be with illustration.
At last, I would like to hear what kind of optimism behind Eva Chen to keep her and the team going and working on new ideas to keep the readers coming back.
To editors, coming up with ideas, writing them, the whole process, it's quite difficult and frustrating, especially the production time. There's loads of sleepless nights before putting the magazine to bed. That could be dampening for the enthusiasm towards the work, but romantically, when I see readers, complete strangers, pick up our magazine in a bookshop and then get inspired by a line of words, a story, or an interview with a particular person, that's what keeps me going from day to day.
浪漫，但是真的在书店看到读者，你不认识的人。
That was Monocle's Kurt Lin reporting from Taipei. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Also thanks to Mag Culture's Jeremy Leslie for a lovely print summary of ModMag 2016 that he sent us this week. You can find out more about the 2017 iteration via Mag Culture's platforms, and I strongly advise you to do exactly that. Any comments or queries are welcome. As always, you can find Fernando on fp@monocle.com. But from me and the rest of the Stack team, thank you very much for listening.